Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to Wild Horse and Burro Radio, an educational outreach program of Wild Horse Freedom Federation. Wild Horse Freedom Federation has been doing Wild Horse and Burro Radio for almost 5 years now, and all of the archived shows are on the Wild Horse Freedom Federation website. So for those of you who are newer to this issue or just trying to learn more about the BLM's management of our wild horses and burros and our public lands, you can learn about a wide variety of topics from many groups on the archive shows. And I always tell people to go to Cindy McDonald's website called American Herds Blogspot. Even though Cindy has retired, she maintains the blog, and all of the issues and the research are still very relevant today. So you can learn from the best. That's what I think of Cindy McDonald. Anyhow, our guests tonight are wildlife ecologist Craig Downer, environmental scientist Jessica Johnston, and researcher Mary Beth Devlin. And I know all of you are very familiar with Craig, and I met Craig at a tour of the Indian Lakes Road holding facility many, many years ago, and Craig has been very generous, let me stay in his home for a long period of time in between roundups. Craig's a great guy. Jessica Johnston, I believe, Jess, correct me if I'm wrong, but you did your master's thesis on the Twin Peaks herd management area, and Jessica has done several flyovers, a lot of field documentation of both aerial and on the ground of what's been going on at the Twin Peaks herd management area in Northern California on the border of Nevada there. And Mary Beth Devlin is a great researcher, and she's a prolific letter writer to the when the media gets things wrong, and she's been calling in to many, if not all, of the experimental stewardship committee meetings up in Modoc County in Northern California. So Mary Beth, I just want to thank all of you for all the hard work you do. We're going to kick off the show tonight. Craig, I'm going to start the ball rolling with you. So can you please tell our new listeners about the benefits of wild horses and burros on public lands?
And they are valuable and so special. They're real healers and restorers of the ecosystem. And the fact is they are one of the most deeply rooted native presences in North America. They have an amazing role to play. They are not ruminant digesters, and that is very significant because their post-gastric or cecal digestive system is really needed to restore balance. Modern man promotes so many ruminants at unnatural levels.
Cattle. Can you tell explain to our new listeners what a ruminant is?
A ruminant is a multi-stomach pre-gastric or pre-stomach digester who very thoroughly digests what he ingests or eats. Consequently, what comes out, the droppings are don't have much substance. Whereas
like they're crushed seeds or something.
Yeah, the horse and the burro, and also the tapir and rhino and some other animals, herbivores, have a less complete digestion, less firm, complete fermentative process in their cecum, which is after the stomach, and consequently there's much more substance. Now, this is a major factor. It restores soils, and it allows the passage of more intact seeds and creates real fertile seed beds. So this is a major factor, and there are many others that are very positive about the wild horse.
It's almost like the seeds come out in a little pile of fertilizer, or they do.
you can see it that way, and they build soils, and they help build watersheds. And I want to get this in because it's so important, is they can better handle dry, flammable, coarse vegetation than the ruminants, which have to kind of burn up their metabolism to digest the coarser stuff, whereas they can handle it greatly reduce the dry, flammable tinder, which is such a major concern today with the heating up of the earth. And they would be just so valuable in preventing catastrophic fires. They would obviate the expenditure of many millions of dollars in after the fact firefighting and.
Mm-hmm.
And,
not only after that, after the firefighting, then they have to reseed huge areas, and it's usually on livestock grazing along
the horses and burros would do that free of charge. All we have to do is get the authorities to understand that and employ them. And I think they should put all those ones they've gathered back out in areas where they would be incredibly valuable in that respect.
Well, there's
and
plenty
many
of herd
other
management
respects.
Areas that I think they
can
go back to.
You know, to me and to so many people, it's just their natural beauty is just inspiring, and that's a quality of life issue that so many people that don't have vested interests that work against cloud their vision. They recognize how special these wonderful animals are and that they deserve as much freedom and naturalist lifestyle as we can, and that's what the Wild Free Roaming Horse and Burros Act intended to do and should still do. It's still the law. We just have to get it to be enforced.
That's true.
Get them restored, get them restored where they belong and in many other areas where they have such a wonderful role to play. And as you know, I wrote the book, The Wild Horse Conspiracy, and I have a website by that name, too. I have a petition called Stop the Excessive Roundups, and I will be delivering that petition. So it's a
You know
move
what I'll
on.
Do, Craig? I meant to put a link to that petition on the radio show promos. So after the show tonight, I'll try and get it up on all
I would
of the
really
promos
appreciate
so people can
so
find the
next,
petition.
I will be delivering that very soon, as promised, in Washington, D.C. And if people could hang on and comment, I'd really appreciate it.
Great. One other point I wanted to make out, you to explain to our newer listeners, because we get new people all the time. What are the difference in the teeth between, say, cattle and wild horses, and how how does that affect the grass and forage?
Yeah, the bovids don't have upper incisors, whereas the equids do. So do the tapirs and rhinos. So that permits them to nip and prune their vegetation more selectively, whereas, like a cow, deer, sheep, they have to often just wrap their tongue around and kind of give it a big sidewise motion where it kind of shears off against their, which can result in the pulling up of roots of many, so many plants. So other thing about the horses is how they move around a lot. I mean, they do not camp on these. Their nature is to move. Look at those long legs, those muscles. They are very mobile, and they naturally rest, rotate, or disperse their grazing pressure. That's their nature, unless they're forced into it by fences and restricting the access to water and other things that mainly people do.
Right.
No, that's amazing. About the upper and lower incisors that they have.
Because the horses don't tear up the grass by the roots. They don't tear up the forage by the roots.
No, they can nip it very carefully, and they have what they call, and I've studied this as an ecologist, they call it called patchiness of grazing. Their grazing or foraging pattern is has a patchiness to it, where they're aware, and they leave certain patches to set seed. And I think this is an instinct that has evolved over millions of years to prevent, you know, destroying their food, their plant food.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, they're one of the most ancient presences among mammals on this earth. And particularly, most all their evolution was right here in North America. So, you know, to say they're a destructive
invasive species,
it's so
yeah.
wrong. It's a blatant disregard of their greater story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it seems like special interests have been so long repeating that misinformation to the media over and over again. And luckily, we've got Mary Beth out there correcting that too.
oh yeah, yeah, and Jessica also.
Yeah. So Jessica, can you give us kind of an overview of some of the conservation issues concerning wild horses and burros?
Yeah, and first I wanted to say thank you, Debbie, for, you know, setting the stage for this show every week and making sure everybody's on task, and appreciate your work and your efforts as well.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
With that, you know, I think kind of the question that I get asked a lot are, why are wild horses and burros so important? And as a conservation or a preservation type issue, I think it's really important to remember, and it kind of ties into what Craig was just saying, is that these are, you know, as definition, both molecular and in theory, a native species. And they are important to the ecosystem. They, you know, part of the issue that comes up a lot is they're not classified as native. And this is one of the big challenges, I think, that face wild horses and burros, is that without that classification, you know, they lack the protections that are needed to really make sure that the species survives in North America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they fit the definition as native by both origin and having co-evolved in this habitat. And I think it's really important that we take notice of this for two reasons. Is one of them is those protections, like I said, but number two is the reasons why they're not provided those protections. And if you look at other issues like that are going on in the Great Basin, the sage grouse, for instance, you know, the reasons behind them not providing those protections, because it really puts limitations on exploiting our public land. And it's really important that we look at those things in a big picture, because when you start taking and diminishing these ecosystems with mining, livestock grazing, water quality diminishment. Off-road vehicles. I mean, we can go on and on and on, but once they have these types of protections, it protects the habitat and the other wildlife, the flora and fauna in these areas.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really important that we look at kind of the bigger picture if we're really going to look at protecting them, because under the current, I guess, system that is the laws provided by the BLM, they're not afforded any of these protections. They're really subject to whatever management that is at a very local level being decided.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different at the different HMAs and in the different states, because these decisions are being made, you know, more locally by the interest groups in those areas, being the miners, the livestock, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
off-road vehicle interests. So I think it's really important, you know, those are some of those issues that we look at kind of like going forward that we really need to keep our voice and our focus on.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those, you know, challenges right now, you know, that are facing the wild horses and burros are the continued, you know, and it's a sensitive subject, and I don't want to take it lightly, but the continued, you know, human population growth, you know, which is really our number one environmental problem right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we look at this extreme, you know, stress on our planet as resources become more scarce across, you know, especially here in the West, as our land starts to be, you know, our public open space is slowly, you know, getting smaller and smaller. We have less of it, and our resources are being exploited. They're being shipped overseas, et cetera. We could go on and on. But mm-hmm. I think that it's really important that we look at that. And, you know, I don't know how, I don't have the answer for that, but I think it's an important issue that we focus on, that some of what are the core issues behind driving some of these, like, politically driven policies that surround mm-hmm. our public lands.
Yeah.
You know, we have to think about how we live in our consumptive habits. That, because, you know, it is the sheer numbers of people, but it's also their consumerist habits. For example, meat eating, very wasteful of resources.
I think more and more people are becoming aware of how much water goes to what food sources and things like that. I just, out of the blue, I thought of one more thing that wild horses do that we forgot to mention, Craig, and that's break ice in the winter for wildlife.
With global warming. But it's still an issue in many areas, of course.
Mm-hmm.
They can help many, many other animals to survive, and also opening up thickets. Another thing is they actually help the ruminants, because often the coarser vegetation will overshade. But when they open that up through grazing, through their upper incisors and their post-gastric digestion, they permit the more tender seedlings to sprout up, which is what the deer and the ruminants are more pre-adapted to handle. That's more beneficial. And there's mm-hmm. been some studies along that line proving that beyond the shadow of a doubt that I give reference in my published words.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We've had Mary Beth patiently waiting. So, Mary Beth, can you tell us some about the problems with BLM statistics on wild horse and burro populations?
Yes, I think the thing that jumps out the most is that they are substituting the birth rate, the average birth rate, and counting that as the herd growth rate.
Mm-hmm.
But those are two different things. The birth rate must be adjusted by the high foal mortality rate
yeah.
and also by the adult mortality rate. And that doesn't seem to be happening. The
mm-hmm.
BLM, you'll hear that over and over, 20% a year, and they double in 4 years. It's like a mantra with them.
Mm-hmm.
And the 20% was supported by a recent research study by Greg and colleagues that found a 20% birth rate across herds. However, there was an earlier study cited McCourt in 1984, who was going off of the National Research Council 1980 report that said it was only 17%. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you think a birth rate of 17 to 20%, that range, you can't get to growth from there, because the foal death rate ranges anywhere from about 32% to 50%
mm-hmm.
in the first
mm-hmm.
year.
In the first year.
In the
yeah.
first year. They don't even make it to yearling.
Yeah.
And okay. And then adult death rate, a lot of this stuff we haven't been able to get at until more recently, but the BLM in its Smoke Creek EA last year said 3 to 20% would be the death rate among adults, which has a median of 11.5. So if you combine those, foaling rate with the foal mortality rate with the adult mortality rate, now I'm seeing certainly no more than 5% growth a year, and
mm-hmm.
it's looking more like 2% the more
wow.
I look into this. Yes, and a recent EA, they mentioned, the BLM brought out very strongly two points. One, that in long-term holding, there was a mortality rate of 8% a year, and they very emphatically said, and the horses in holding live a lot longer than those on the range. So that supported the higher than 8%, whereas I had been going by a 5% death rate. It's looking more like the 10 to 11.5% is more accurate as far as that. So when you see this 20%, 20%, 20% every year, it cannot be valid. And
it's,
if that
well,
were
political.
Yeah, but I mean, if it stopped at that, that would be one thing. But we're seeing, you know, 78%, 100%, 300%, 500%, 1,000% in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
So,
believe they herd animals around, including the rancher. I have a lot of evidence for that, actually. Conveniently herding them from place to place to, like, pad the census, and, you know, so there's a lot of double counting going on between the different areas, triple counting. And another thing I wanted to interject is, you know, because I've been doing these ecological evaluations and reserve design field projects, and I've come across that there's a real increase in the illegal activities on our public lands, including killing and capturing and removal of the wild horses and burros.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard evidence of that too, where secret traps are being set up, and I know the wild burros are being removed, and there's a lot going on. I wanted to get back to something Mary Beth said really, really quickly, the long-term holding mortality, 8% a year.
Yeah.
I wonder if that, you know, I have a lot of the I have filed FOIAs for a lot of the facility reports over the years, so I might share that information with you so you can double-check those statistics. But, you know, that makes me wonder, is the BLM counting the horses that they ship out because they're sale authority? Like, you know, do they then count those as dead or, you know, shipped out or what? It's very, you know, the record-keeping has a lot of problems, as people can learn from our the white paper Wild Horse Freedom Federation did last year. There's the record keeping is not what it should be. A lot of problems with it.
I believe there's falsification of horses on the range and off the range in both cases.
And again, in our white paper, I absolutely know it. The number of horses the BLM claim and that the contractors claim and are getting paid for when they send in their invoices monthly. Well, we went on investigations, and the number of horses they claim are there, we could not see or find. And you're driving right through the middle of some of these places. So basically they're getting paid for nothing. And another thing, by contract, observers are supposed to go once a week, and, you know, and when they send in their invoice, they're supposed to say who observed the horses and, you know, make notes and send it in. And in all the invoices I've ever seen, I haven't seen those notes. They're supposed to say, you know, like John Doe went out on this date. And so once a week they're supposed to do that, and I've never seen that included with any invoices. So.
Oh, that's disgraceful.
You know, I wanted to add to what Mary Beth had to say. We evaluated back in 2014, Lisa LeBlanc and my mom, Kathy Gregg, and myself, evaluated data that we had received from BLM on five different HMAs. And what we found is what we called full survival rates and what foals had survived after that first year. And we found 10%. And, you know, that was just on one data set. So when you take their data and you analyze it, you come up with very different results. The 10% obviously doesn't include any death rates on the range. So you can start backing off of 10% as you start to look at the information that's being provided. So, yeah, 10% survive, but how many die? Like you said,
You saying that only 10% of the foals survive their first year?
Yes.
Wow, that is really...
Actually, I was on a tour of the Twin Peaks herd management, a BLM tour of the herd Twin Peaks herd management area many years ago, and Bill Phillips, who used to be a BLM manager up there, he came right out and said most foals do not survive. Most wild foals do not survive. So, anyhow, Jessica, what's the big picture when it comes to wild horse and burro populations? I mean, didn't you go on a count one time? And what do you think of the way that BLM handles their field on the ground count?
Well, I haven't attended any of their particular counts. I've been out with them in the field, but what I can tell you I did as part of working on my grad work is that post the roundup. So part of my work has just been a focus on Twin Peaks, trying to use Twin Peaks as a model to be able to look at other HMAs, because there's so many different moving parts. To at least have a model, a guideline, to have like a different perspective to look at the other HMAs. Part of what we have done, and Craig and I have both done this together, is we completed our own independent surveys. We've done 6 different flights since 2010. Almost annually, every year, we do a flight over Twin Peaks, and it's a flight that's donated by the Lighthawks. And they provide the flight. We have a high-wing plane. We go out. We have transects. We fly, you know, hundreds of miles. We take GoPro. We take pictures. And what we do is we survey a certain section. So we randomly select a flight path. And then we survey that area. And then we take the survey results in the area that we covered, and we extrapolate that into an estimated population, low range and high range. So we've been able to track the population growth post the last roundup, which was in 2010 in Twin Peaks. So we're able to see the growth in the population over the last 7 years, and I expect we'll probably be doing another flight probably in the next couple months.
Let's go.
Usually do them late. I need to do that, Craig. We usually do them later.
I want to interject about the Twin Peaks. An important proof that exists in Twin Peaks is that after the 2010 roundup, and I warned them that gutting the herd of wild horse and burros would likely cause a catastrophic fire, and it did. It came about 2 years later. There was the terrible Rush Mountain fire that burned one of the in California history, and I'm sure it was directly related to removing those horses and burros and just leaving much smaller fraction. And they fought out for a long time. It was quite an extensive fire, almost 320,000 acres.
Well, Jessica, so when you went out on the field with the BLM, what were you doing when you went out with the BLM in the field? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So they only took me out one time, and then shortly after that stopped answering my phone calls, by the way. Sometimes I get an email back. But they took me out in the field. They kind of showed me different areas that the horses were in, and I had a lot of questions. And like I said, I did my focus on Twin Peaks. It's about 800,000 acres there. It's a large area. And the more questions I asked, the kind of less responsive they were. And part of what I was asking while we were out there is because they have what they call home ranges in Twin Peaks. So within this 800,000 acres, they have it subdivided into 5 sections. And this is part of that modeling, things to look for if you're looking at an HMA. They had it subdivided in 5 different sections. And then within those sections, they were all fenced. And those what they called home ranges for horses were essentially big pastures for livestock. So those horses were
fenced off, pretty much
captive in fenced off in those 5 areas within the HMA. And that was one of the things I learned, and I was able to get some maps, and I laid over the home ranges with the livestock allotments, and there you go. You can see it laid perfectly over the top of each other. And
so that
what I'm talking about is
the free roaming mandate of the act.
Right.
Well,
and what I'm talking about fences, these are new fences. These are fences they keep up. These are not fences that, you know, are some old pasture fence.
Oh, I know.
These are, right.
Well, even after the Rush fire, the fence, you know, taxpayers paid a lot of money for a big fence to go up, and it turned out to be right on the edge of one of the livestock grazing. It was a big old gift to whoever that livestock grazer was, and, you know, put up
right.
a big fence for him. I guess it was a nice fence with stones and everything that we all paid
yeah,
for.
They,
and then they
yeah,
were
they put
reseeding.
A lot of money into it.
And the areas that were being reseeded were where the cattle grazed. So that was real interesting
right.
About that.
And there's a lot to be learned about the flights when you're in the air, as Craig can tell you. You can see water diversions. You can see the impacts of the juniper removal project. We flew shortly after the fire. They wanted to remove the horses from the fire. We documented pictures and said this is not a wholesale burn. This is a patchwork of areas that have been burned. There's still plenty of vegetation. The horses will provide an ecological service by reseeding those areas.
Right.
So we were able to see a lot of things from the air that were really kind of, I think, maybe things that are needed to be said to the BLM. So we had information, we had facts, we had documentation, which, you know, really limited their ability to go in and remove horses at will.
Yes, after the fire, they were out there to remove the dead horses that had been burned up against the fences. They were desperate because they didn't want the public to see that.
Oh, my God.
You know, not only horses, but other animals, too. Deer and cows that got trapped. And the by fire.
Well, and Jessica, you've also seen when you go out there, you pretty know what the what months and what dates the grazing livestock grazers are supposed to be on certain areas. And haven't you gone out there where there's what we know as trespass grazing? They're grazing a lot of sheep or certain areas
too. We document that from our flights through the air as well as on the ground. So there's been times I've come around a corner and all of a sudden there's a sea of sheep that shouldn't be there. And I'm not talking like a small flock of sheep. I'm talking thousands and thousands of sheep. And it looks disorienting. There's so many out there where and they're in areas they shouldn't be. And before I go out there, I always know where the livestock should be or shouldn't be before we enter the field. That way we can document that. But we've seen thousands of sheep out there, cows where they're not supposed to be. It's blatant.
Have you ever reported it to the BLM when you've seen that?
Yes. I've sent pictures and documentation, and they send them out there, you know, or so they say. But as far as I'm aware, every time I've followed up, there's been no fines. There's been no consequences for the livestock trespass on those areas. I'm yet to see any consequences for that.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold my breath either. Mary Beth, do you have any specific data regarding the population of Twin Peaks?
Something I found very interesting after that 2010 call, at which point they had removed 59% of the herd, something like that, injected the mares with PZP, and skewed the gender ratio in favor of males or stallions 60-40. When in the first year after you inject with PZP, it's not in effect. You have to wait till the following year to be in effect. But the year that it was in effect, they recorded a 40% herd increase. So with you have a much smaller proportion of mares, you have them contraceptive, and yet it's a double the what they say is the average birth rate. So and the same with the burros. That same period, they recorded a 61% increase in the burro herd. Again, totally impossible for that to happen.
Biologically impossible, yeah. So, Craig and Mary Beth, can you talk a little bit about the recent report on 5 wild horse and burro herd management areas in Oregon?
Yeah, sure. Do you want to go first, Mary Beth?
Well, the same type of thing where you have these incredible increases alleged 78%, 95%, 101%, here's another one, 67% in 1 year. over and over we're finding these, and they remove horses to below AML, and then the next thing you know, there's a huge increase in supposedly in the population. It has to be falsification. These people are not stupid. You know, they are got college degrees in range management. They are well aware that this can't happen. To me, this whole thing is to create the illusion, the perception of a crisis, of a greatly expanding population that must be dealt with immediately. And here's another one. Recently, there was this Muddy Creek, Utah EA. And
and for the new people, an EA is an environmental assessment.
Right.
Yeah.
And the current population created a stocking density of one wild horse per 2.25 square miles. And BLM said, oh, no, that's overpopulated. We have to go in. We have to cull every 4 times in the next 10 years. We have to contracept, and we have to adjust the sex ratios to favor the males. And the goal being there should be one wild horse per 6 square miles. It's totally preposterous that mm-hmm. you know, to even think of this. One of the ones in Oregon, I believe we're talking about 3 fingers. Let's see if this is it. One of them, anyhow, it's 8 square miles per wild horse is the management level.
Now, that sounds like that Beatty or Butte. I didn't cover it, but Paisley was very similar. Paisley Desert.
Maybe it was Paisley, yeah. Paisley was 8, and Beatty's Butte was 7. But they're all very high, you know, very mm-hmm. high.
Yeah, and I did quite an evaluation. There was 5 herds that I entered and evaluated, and I did ecological evaluations in 3 of those following the manual for range evaluation. And then I also, when I wrote up the report, made recommendations on about half of them for how to set up a reserve design.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, the 5 areas I covered was Big Summit, up there in the Ochoco National Forest,
mm-hmm.
and that is a very sinister place as far as the treatment of the wild horses.
Mm-hmm.
They're really persecuted there, and you could tell
yeah.
by how scared they were of human presence.
Well, there's a great group of advocates
was,
fighting for them up there, I think. So, yeah.
The Central Oregon Gail Hunt really dedicated.
Yeah.
And then there was
she does a great job. Yeah.
Yeah, Paisley Desert, where I didn't see a single one. I was there for a few days, but I saw like all kinds of must have been nearly 1,000 cattle, very monopolized by the cattle industry. And then I did ecological evaluations in the South Steens herd management area, really spectacular area. And then just to the north, which is sort of like an extension of the northern Steens Mountains, is the famous Kyger Mustang. And I just found such hypocrisy there, like these wonderful Spanish colonial Kyger Mustangs, and there were so few left, and their area was just totally monopolized by cattle.
Mm-hmm,
they had
mm-hmm.
everything, and the few bands I saw were, again, really scared, really afraid, and quickly ran off. So that tells me a lot right there, you know. And then the one where I did very extensive work was 3 fingers in southeast Oregon, where I believe they used that Cherry Road fire. They just let it happen, and they used that as an excuse to gut the herd, and not one has been put back. But now it's full of cattle. Just
interesting.
Brimming with cattle.
Oh. Wow.
Just terrible injustice. So I wrote that up, and that's and thanks so much for posting that on the RT Fitch blog. Also on my website. And God, a lot of people did. It was an eye opener for them. So I encourage people to share that. And I did send it to the BLM and the authorities, but as you would expect, they just sort of try and ignore it and hope
We've never, even though we did that white paper last June or July, I can't remember, it came out last summer, we sent it to many members of both the House and the Senate. I don't think we've gotten one letter from them asking, you know, we have a lot of additional information, include Grandma Greg has done, every herd for many years, the statistics of increases. And so we have that at the ready to give them. It was like something like 300 or 400 pages. So our attorney didn't want to formally put it in with the exhibit because we already had several hundred pages of exhibits, which were BLM's own documents. Anyhow, but we have a lot of stuff.
You need a law that will require it, perhaps set up a separate wild horse and burro agency that is separate from these ones that just serve the big money interests, the big established interests, and then give them charge over those legal areas we can restore.
And that leads to the question I wanted to ask you guys, each of you next. Can each of you give me some examples of how livestock interests dominate the wild horse and burro issue? And Jess, I think I want to start with you on this because, as I recall, weren't you somewhere or thinking about doing, they were trying to figure out what damage was caused by wild horses, but they didn't want to consider cattle at all, something like that?
So in Twin Peaks, there's 82% of the forage allocation goes to livestock and 18% to the wild horses and burros. Then they had a solicitation out for volunteers to go out into the field. This was about probably 6 years ago. They had a solicitation out for volunteers to go out into the field, and they wanted to look at the impacts of wild horses and burros on the riparian area. But they weren't going to account for any livestock. It was going to be all attributed to wild horses and burros. So when I had this phone call, because of course I called to volunteer my time and my effort, and when I started asking questions about, well, how are you looking at the livestock? Well, they weren't looking at any livestock. It was going to be all attributed to the wild horses and burros. So with the numbers that I just gave you, the ratio of livestock out there to wild horses and burros, really the question would be, where are the wild horses and burros impact in comparison to all of the livestock? Like, because the way they utilize the riparian systems and the waterways are completely different. But this whole study was designed to put a slant on the wild horse and burro impact and pretty much be silent on the livestock. Yeah, and of course I didn't get picked as a volunteer, and then I was told that.
You wonder why.
And then I was told that the whole program was being rescinded later on, because as I pressed on, it was being rescinded. They weren't going to fund it. That funding was being reallocated to something else, maybe fences, I'm guessing. But that's, you know, that's something that I've seen over and over where they've just focused on something.
Yeah, and I just have to say
they wanted an answer.
I have
Go ahead.
So they had it predetermined what they wanted, who they wanted to blame the damage on. It was wild horses and burros.
Right.
Real quick, funny story. I mean, before I went on that tour of Twin Peaks, Carla Bowers told me, be sure and take pictures of cow patties on the ground. And I thought, why the hell is she telling me to, why is she telling me to do that? Well, anyhow, we go on this tour, and they were going to take us to a riparian area that had been, quote, unquote, damaged by wild horses and burros. And I'm not kidding. Every 3 feet, there was cow patties all over. It was just, a field of cow patties. And I got lots of pictures of it for Carla. So, the BLM's blaming. We get out there, and they're going, oh, the wild horses and burros did that. So it's kind of funny.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, that's been happening for years. And Don Moldy here in Reno really puts it humorously about you know, the cow pies and how they will overlook them but then intentionally blame the wild horses, who generally very neatly trail into water and then leave. They don't linger. Their nature, they're very mobile animals.
Yeah. And Mary Beth, you've listened in. There's a kind of a subcommittee, and there's, I can't remember how many, if there's four or five of them around the West, these experimental stewardship committees. And they have meetings, which we've asked them up in the Modoc, which is Northern California, to do a teleconference so we can actually listen to what they're saying. And then they allow us some public comment time, a few minutes to make public comments. And they usually, you know, try and do the wild horses and burros early, so hoping that we won't listen to the rest of what they're talking about, or they can get back to talking about it there later after they think we've all signed off. But Mary Beth listens to many of those meetings. And, you know, I know there was somebody on their BLM's Resource Advisory Committee, Sean Curtis. He's a very powerful cattleman up there. And they've been trying to manipulate the resource management plans for years and environmental assessments. So, but maybe Mary Beth can give us a little bit more insight about what happens at these little special interest meetings.
Well, they seem to be particularly focused on the wild horses. I mean, most of the meeting, it's incredible how it always goes to that. That's their focus. Mm-hmm. It's an obsession almost.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I wanted to say, in Wyoming, you have the Rock Springs Grazing Association.
Yeah.
And just a few months ago, there was a plane crash of BLM staff and others who were doing a census. They were not in a helicopter, but in a fixed-wing aircraft. Mm-hmm. And it was revealed that one of the people doing the census was a member of this Rock Spring Grazing Association,
mm-hmm.
which to me seems inappropriate.
Well, didn't they pay for it, too? I think
they may have, you know, but
yeah,
the whole thing
Spring,
is,
yeah.
Yeah, this is the kind of stuff that is, you know.
Yeah, it's very flagrant.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why these aerial counts that Craig and Jessica have been doing for years are so important. I'm sure that's why more the rest of the wild horses haven't been rounded up yet. It's because
and Jessica's also helped me do the count here in the Pinettes.
Mm-hmm.
And I also did a flight over the Three Fingers herd management area there in Southeast
mm-hmm.
Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been very helpful. That Light Hawk is just great, and because they want people to be objective and get the greater truth. And one thing you notice is how drained so many of these arid and semi-arid areas, the spring source, the water sources are being siphoned off from the mountains, and that's really, you know, killing. It's killing the wild communities, the plants.
Mm-hmm.
You can see these lush fields and big sprinkler irrigation ponds and whatever, you know. And then you'll see the dying ecosystem up in the mountains because they're taking their water, you know.
Yeah. And what I've noticed that I just want to let the public know, these livestock ranchers that are grazing their privately owned cattle on public lands act like they own the public lands. That's a really big thing.
Yep.
And I have one thing I wanted to bring up here was an advocate recently suggested to me that we need to think outside the box. And then this person described an idea, and it was this, to create a commons, quote-unquote commons, and this apparently would mean zeroing out herd management areas where there weren't, you know, there were fewer numbers of wild horses and burros, which could be a lot of them at this point. Which would mean zeroing out the herd management areas. Then all these horses would be moved to a location called a commons. So besides this plan requiring that we're going to give up more herd management area land, the person also said, oh, this would also mean we'd have to open up the act for change. Well, to me, it would seem really risky to open up the Wild Free Roaming Horse and Burro Act unless we're just adding an amendment to make it stronger. And here's my thought on this. why not put privately owned livestock on a commons instead of the wild horses and burros?
Actually, well, I'm in agreement with you there. So serious and such a blatant betrayal of the true intention of the act to have the herds dispersed throughout the West, so that there you have a diversity in their quality of life issue wherever you go for the common man.
You know, we've been covering so many. Go ahead.
You know, when you said think outside of the box, I was waiting for this great idea, and that seems like that would be going into the box and shutting the lid.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, to me, you know, we need to be moving in the other direction where we continue to open up land. And you know, I think part of it is, you know, really changing how these populations interact, you know, because they're really on these little sub-islands of areas.
They've
kind of been pushed
from.
They're fenced off within the HMA.
Catherine's reports, many of them have a caveat and have for years that the herds will be okay if they get to, you know, mingle with other herds. But because of the fencing, they don't. And now, and, you know, now that the numbers are so low, they don't get to mingle much. So,
right.
You know, we've only got about 10 minutes left. And one subject I wanted to bring up tonight when I have you all here are, what are your thoughts about PZP fertility control? And Mary Beth, I'm going to let you start off with this one.
Well, I feel that given the falsification of records, you don't dare do anything like that, not even have a roundup, not even, contraception, nothing. You just don't know what the truth is. And these numbers are so out of whack that I just have no confidence in anything they say.
Mm-hmm.
In addition,
their numbers aren't realistic, and so basically, and even where they are low, I was looking at one agreement. Somebody was it was like a rough draft of an agreement that Return to Freedom was going to sign, and it was for fertility control. But one of the herds only had like 45 horses. I thought, and they're thinking this is being included to give fertility control to this group of horses.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have a lot of concerns about giving any fertility control. Sex ratio skewing anything unless we have, viable herd numbers.
Exactly.
And it's problematic for all of those. I just read that article that you posted, that professional article.
Mm-hmm.
It was illuminating. And they one things the PZP does is it sets up the populations in future generations for decline and die out, because the ones that have the weaker immune systems upon which it isn't as effective, they're the ones that end up reproducing the most. And another thing it's causing is those who do restore their fertility after a few years often abort or have malformed foals. And I've heard that from so many people now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very serious. So, you know, it might look like, a nice benign solution to the non-overpopulation, but it is not. It's not this solution that they claim.
Yeah, like a silver bullet. And my concern is they focus so much on that they're you know, basically – actually, before I say anything, Jessica, do you want to weigh in on that one at all? Or,
you know, there is no overpopulation. We have, wild horses and burros are struggling to survive as we speak. And so to me, it's kind of a non-conversation. That's not even a conversation that's even close to being on the table as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And what I wanted to say, it's my opinion that some advocacy groups are very conciliatory. And by saying things like, when they're talking about using fertility control, like, be realistic. Well, in other words, the ranchers and the BLM who caters to the ranchers have their heels dug in. So we're the ones that are supposed to compromise, But when these other advocacy groups are giving in doing so, they're compromising more and more of the wild horses and burros' rightful place as part of the thriving natural ecological balance. And what I think all advocates need to continue to ask themselves is, why isn't the BLM considering a major, quote-unquote, tool in their toolbox, because they always use that term, to be reducing or rescinding livestock grazing on herd management areas? And why aren't advocates more steadfast in demanding this instead of talking about fertility control on mostly non-viable herds? You know, we've got a few minutes left before I have to wrap up the show, so I wanted to give each one of you a minute or so just to, if we forgot to say anything tonight, and I think we did because we actually skipped over a lot of questions I wanted to ask you, but, you know, maybe one major point you want to stress here at the end of the show. Craig, I'll let you go first.
Yeah, you know, that Code of Federal Regulation 4710.5 would allow the BLM to cancel out grazing permits in order for the health and well-being of the wild horses and burros, but they rarely use that. And I would just like to say that now it's more critical than ever, because they're trying to, you know, get their way 100% on eliminating, or nearly so, just have a few dysfunctional, non-viable little token herds. They want to give the wild horse, you know, adverse parties nearly 100% of their way, and that, it is disgraceful. We must fight it in the Congress, and we should say, hey, we got to restore these herds because they're not viable and the law is being broken, and we need to reduce the stranglehold of the public lands ranchers and other interests that are trying to monopolize our public lands. This is general public issue, and it's a quality of life issue, and it's very important. These are wonderful beings that share the earth with us and have done so much, and we owe it to them. We can't have another broken treaty for the wild and burros.
Jessica, you have a last minute statement to make to everybody?
Yeah, two things. One of them is I want to stand corrected on the annual herd increase before I get a nasty phone call from my mother that it's not 10% of the foals survive. Is we factored that information, that annual herd increase at 10% from foal survival rate. So there's a big math problem that went in front of that. Besides that, I just want to, you know, I want people to take notice, and I think it's really important that wild horses are important, but it's about looking at the entire ecosystem and how these policies and these laws impact the entire ecosystem and our public lands.
Mary Beth?
I'd also like to point out that predators are a factor, and, you know, BLM keeps insisting that there are no natural predators, but yet there are herds that are, you know, kept in control by predators, by mountain lions and other predators. And I think that lie has to be debunked.
Yeah, if Wildlife Services wasn't killing off millions of animals out there. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, anyhow, I'd like to thank Craig and Jessica and Mary Beth for being on our show tonight, but also for all of your hard work. Craig's website is wildhorseconspiracy.org. I'd also like to thank my producer, Marty Oakley, and let you know that Marty produces other shows on TS Radio, including Whistleblowers on Thursday nights. Marty, you want to tell everybody about the Whistleblower Conference coming up in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, it's July 30th and 31st. The public is cordially welcome, and this is where all the whistleblowers out of the federal agencies come in and talk about what's going on. We are going to have a panel there again this year on guardianship and family court abuse. And by the way, in case your listeners don't know, they usually have a huge section on wildlife and the environment here in the United States. And that's, like I say, July 30th and 31st. And it's quite the deal out in D.C. if you can make it.
Great. Well, we'll bring it up again and let people know on our next radio show, too. I also want to remind our listeners to catch Debbie Dahmer doing her show Voices Carry for Animals, and I think it's on Animal Advocates Radio. I think that's her new channel. Okay, and then we also have some great shows lined up in the future, including our friends at Buffalo Field Campaign who will be coming back really soon because events are taking a turn for the worse for our last true genetically pure bison in Yellowstone National Park. So again, thank you, Craig, Jessica, Mary Beth. You guys were great, and thanks so much for all that you're doing, and to all of our listeners.
Do it again sometime.
We will. It's great. Yeah, I still have half my questions.
Thank you, Debbie.
So. Sure. And thanks to all of our listeners, and we'll see you again soon, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.